there are speakers that you think would have a good perspective. We value your input very much, and we're in an exciting time. There's going to be a lot of changeover in agencies. A lot of issues will be revisited. So we're looking forward to the programming that we'll have throughout this year. Now, my job here is just to introduce the Honorable Judge Nelson, who's going to be moderating our panel. Judge Nelson's been on the Ninth Circuit for about 6 years. And before that, he was a general counsel in private practice. He's had a number of important roles in Washington, D.C. He was a senior counsel on nominations. He worked at the Department of Justice. And before that, he clerked on the D.C. Circuit and graduated from BYU University and law school. So thank you very much for being with us, Judge. And please take it away. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the introduction. And I'm grateful to the Federal Society and the Financial Services Practice Group for inviting me to moderate this discussion. And it's a particular pleasure to be joined by our three panelists, John Court, Will Hild, and Professor Todd Zwicky. Just as a little bit of background to lead into this subject, we all know that disputes over federal banking have been a feature of American political discourse since the earliest days of the Republic. Congress chartered the first Bank of the United States in 1791, defeating widespread resistance from the likes of Thomas Jefferson and James Madison. The second bank came 25 years later and was, as we all learned in our constitutional law class, the opposition did not subside. McCulloch versus Maryland upheld Congress's power to charter a national bank, but its most memorable line came in striking down Maryland's attempt to tax the bank. As Chief Justice Marshall famously wrote, the power to tax involves the power to destroy. It has been a fundamental principle of our constitutional law ever since that states have no power by taxation or otherwise to interfere with instrumentalities of the federal government, such as a national bank. Fast forward to today. The dual banking system created by the National Bank Act allows privately owned banks to choose a federal or state charter. A federal charter subjects a bank to federal oversight and regulation, and a state charter banks, they must comply with additional state requirements. In dividing this regulatory authority between the national government and the states, American banking laws rely heavily on the doctrine of federal preemption. The key question has always been, as it was in McCulloch, the scope of this preemption. To what extent can state laws govern nationally chartered banks, and where should the line be drawn between federal authority and state regulation? Federal courts regularly face these issues. Just last term, the Supreme Court in Cantero versus Bank of America clarified the preemption analysis under the National Bank Act, and in my opinion, in McShannock versus J.P. Morgan Chase Bank, we held in the Ninth Circuit that the Federal Homeowners Loan Act preempted a California law requiring the payment of interest on escrow accounts, even for mortgages issued by a savings association and later assigned to a national bank. These cases highlight the delicate balance between state and federal authority. In our federal system, states presumably have authority to regulate financial institutions within their borders. But when and how must state law yield, particularly in areas like banking, where a uniform federal system is essential for economic stability and growth? As today's topic suggests, maybe that premise is flawed. Have national bank charters become unworkable? And if so, what are the alternatives? We're lucky to have three distinguished experts to help us navigate these questions. And so I'd like to introduce John Court, who is Executive Vice President, General Counsel, and Chief Operating Officer at the Bank Policy Institute, where he manages the Regulatory Affairs Department and oversees the Institute's legal regulatory advocacy initiatives. He previously spent 10 years in private practice addressing advising clients on various financial regulatory and enforcement matters, most recently as a member of the Financial Institutions Regulatory and Enforcement Group at SCADN. Will Hild is the Executive Director of Consumers Research, a nonprofit whose mission is to increase understanding of issues policies, products, and services of concern to consumers. Before joining Consumers Research, Mr. Hild served as Deputy Director of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project. And Professor Todd Zwicky is the George Mason University Foundation Professor of Law at the Antonin Scalia Law School, where he specializes in, among other things, bankruptcy law, consumer protection, and law and economics. He's widely published in the field of commercial law and previously served as chair of the CFPB's Task Force on Federal Consumer Financial Law. So please join me in welcoming the panelists. And with that, I turn the time over, first of all, to Professor Zwicky to give some opening remarks.
Thanks, Judge Nelson. And I also want to say at the outset, we have three here. I want to say we tried for weeks to try to get a fourth panelist, maybe from a state bank regulator, a consumer advocacy group, a blue state attorney general, a variety of options. We must have contacted at least a dozen or 15 people and weren't able to do so. So I just wanted to let you know that that perspective is not formally represented here, but not for lack of effort. But I think what you're going to discover is a wide variety of views here just on the areas that you think we might otherwise agree. Which I think says something interesting about the moment at which we find ourselves with respect to financial services, which is just like sort of the rest of the conservative movement, there are different threads being pulled here in terms of sort of traditional conservative views, populist conservative views. And I guess, you know, it's typically the case with me. I guess I'm just the moderate here, the wishy-washy guy who will maybe be in the middle of all this. But what I'm going to talk about is I'm going to tee this up by talking a little bit about the history and about how we got to where we are today and why we see these things going on. I'm not sure that I would necessarily agree with Judge Nelson that Quintero clarified what preemption standard is now with respect to the Supreme Court's decision. In fact, I think it shows perhaps more ambiguity about where we are and where we are going. As Judge Nelson talked about, this goes all the way back. He talked about it going back to the Bank of the United States, but it actually goes back even further, which is it goes back to the creation of the Constitution itself. And you need to keep in mind that one of the dynamics that was going on under the Articles of Confederation were these state legislators passing debt relief laws that were often aimed at out-of-state banks or banks more generally. The Fair Faith and Credit Act, a clause of the Constitution, the Bankruptcy Clause of the Constitution, most people don't know, was actually designed to facilitate creditors to be able to collect debts across different state lines. And so one of the things we see in the Constitution itself is an effort to deal with the ongoing threat, as Judge Nelson again alluded to with the McCullough decision, of in-state, especially populist state legislatures, destabilizing sort of debtor-creditor relations and financial services and that sort of thing, especially in a dynamic where you have sort of money centers that may especially be out of state that are lending money, and it's very popular and populist to be able to do that. And so the response we came up with was this dual banking system that Judge Nelson described, where you have a federal banking system that arose out of the Bank of United States structure and really came about during the Civil War, and then these state chartered banks, and how the two relate. Now, this raises then real concerns about both vertical and horizontal federalism as it comes to financial services. Vertical federalism meaning federal-state relations and the extent to which states can impose their regulations on federal banks, and state-to-state as well, because we've always had a variety among different states in their policies with respect to financial services. So, for example, when you go back and you read the debates over the National Bank Act, one of the things they specifically considered and rejected was the imposition of a national usury ceiling as part of the National Bank Act. Why? because what they said was each state should have the authority over its institutions to determine what they wanted to do in terms of a usury ceiling. And so state A might decide that they want to have a restrictive usury ceiling for in-state banks. State B might want to have a looser usury ceiling, so for that, for example, they could attract more capital. And so what we saw at the time in the National Bank Act was Western states in particular had much looser usury ceilings, which is often the case today, such as South Dakota. Why? Because they wanted to be able to attract investment capital, lending capital into the state. And so a lot of these things were delegated to the states with respect to those sorts of regulation. But then you had later on top of it this national bank system. And I talk about that because we'll come back to it in a minute, which is the structure of that then was the authority that states have over their banks as a matter of prudential regulation, as opposed to trying to exercise dominion over their residents wherever they may go. And what we've seen is a flip where that sort of prudential regulation has now been supercharged by some states through consumer protection. And so what we have then is a fairly clear distinction between the national bank system and create a uniform sort of system of regulation for the national bank system, especially to facilitate interstate commerce. And then on the state level, you have this sort of patchwork of different rules where each state had authority over their institutions, both banks and non-banks, with the standard rule being whatever state you are in was the state that governed whatever your transaction was. That's always been a bedrock of this whole system. So what happened? About a century later, what we saw beginning in the 50s and 60s and the 70s was the rise of interstate banking system and really a rise of interstate financial services. And where this really begins with is the department stores, actually, which is as we get chains of department stores like Sears, Sears then takes all of its lending operations, its credit operations, and centralizes it in a particular place, and then it provides services to all the Sears around the country. Then you start to see developments in technology, like telephones in particular. So what we see is a rise of a new set of federal regulations, particularly in the realm of consumer financial protection, which traditionally always been state to state. But take telephones, for example. Traditionally, debt collection had always just been local. But what happens when you get cheap interstate telephones is all of a sudden now you can have a debt collector who lives outside the state calling to collect debts against you inside the state. You have Sears who is outside this, you know, say based in Illinois, servicing accounts in, say, South Carolina through their financial service. So this gives rise to this new layer and activity of federal regulation. Still, though, there isn't that much of a disturbance in the vertical and horizontal credit relationship, mainly because the Supreme Court got it right at that point. And in the 1978 case of Marquette National Bank versus First of Omaha National Bank, the Supreme Court, in a 9-0 opinion written by Justice Brennan, held that when it came to credit cards, the applicable usury ceiling for credit cards, a more general regulatory mechanism, which state's regulation of the banks would apply, would be the state where the bank was chartered, not the state where the consumer resided. And that is a crucial moment in sort of rationalizing and maintaining the federal state sort of horizontal and vertical federalism. And what underlies that case is, Justice Brennan says, everybody knows that, so what happened in that case was a Nebraska bank was marketing credit cards to Minnesota consumers. The Minnesota AG sued and said, this is unfair that you're doing this. And the Supreme Court said, well, why is it unfair? And the Minnesota banks, the Minnesota AG said, and the bank said, well, because in Nebraska they have an 18% usury ceiling, and here in Minnesota we only have a 12% usury ceiling. So that means we need to impose a $10 or $15 annual fee on our customers to make up for the fact that we can't charge a market rate of interest. And that's unfair competition, because consumers really prefer cards that have no annual fee. And to which Robert Bork, who was arguing the case for First Bank of Omaha, said, it sounds to me like they would have been done better to have hired an advertising firm rather than a lawyer to talk about why the Minnesota case was so much better, right? But they basically came up with a solution. The state where the bank is chartered will deal with this. And the foundation of this was, Brennan basically says, everybody knows if you travel into Nebraska and you do everything involving the loan in Nebraska, Nebraska law applies even if you live in Minnesota. And he said, and yes, this is a transaction across state lines because they did it by telephone, but it's really the same thing. So the same basic principle applies. The loan was made in Nebraska, right? And so that was basically the logic. A few years later, DMICA was a law that said the same rule applies for state banks as national banks, kept the whole thing intact. And over time, there were squabbles over federal and state issues. And what becomes important, as hopefully we'll talk about later, is a lot of this is done through preemption, and in particular, sub-regulatory guidance is the mechanism by which the federal government protects the national bank system against the states by issuing guidances and the like. And query what happens now after Loper-Bright, when so much of this done is by done by supervision, guidance, examination, and the like. And I think this is something perhaps John Court will say more about. So that brings us up to the present now. So we had a pretty good understanding of sort of how this all fit together. Not a lot of controversy. What happens? First, we get a lot of kind of blue state AGs and consumer advocates have never really liked Marquette because they've wanted to impose their uses. Then we get the financial crisis. And one of the theories that comes out, particularly from blue state AGs, is the federal government was preempting too many good state consumer protection laws, and that's what led to the financial crisis. So Dodd-Frank dramatically rolls back the ability of the federal government to preempt state laws. And this had been, until recently, the consistent position of Democrats is that they are against against preemption. So that's one side. Now on the other side, what have we gotten? Now on the other side, we start having conservatives, and I think we'll speak to this, becoming more skeptical, and so I'll just briefly summarize, becoming more skeptical about what's going on also. Why? Basically because of the weaponization of the banking system for political reasons, whether willingly, unwillingly, or some combination. Some seem to be maybe pushed more than others, but we've seen a targeting of guns, we've seen ESG, we've seen DEI, and most notoriously, we saw Operation Choke Point during the Obama administration of weaponizing the financial system, and so over the national government. Surprisingly, not making this up, all of a sudden the Democrats have rediscovered preemption. I don't know if you know that. In the context of Florida's anti-debanking law, all of a sudden they've discovered that some state laws are very problematic. And so that's where things stand right now, is everything is a mess, basically. We see NRA versus VULO, where the state regulators were specifically targeting the NRA for their political speech. The Supreme Court struck that down, but as we saw in Murphy versus Missouri, they essentially didn't give us much guidance. At the same time, we see states, and especially blue state AGs, aggressively meddling in horizontal federalism. So things like loans made elsewhere laws, which you may not know about, but I was involved in a case as an expert witness involving this, where consumer travels from state A to state B, conducts all the transactions in state B. State A still says their usury ceilings apply to a loan where everything is done in state B. States such as Colorado have started talking about opting out of, or have opted out under DMICA, the law I said earlier, with respect to state banks, and there's litigation over what that means. We've got the New York AG, and I think John will talk more about this, so I'll just mention it. The New York AG trying to get involved in the Discover Capital One merger. And so what we have right now is total chaos caused partly by political activity, partly by the banks bringing scrutiny on themselves simply by wading into controversial issues that they didn't used to wade into. And so I've talked about a lot of problems, and then I'm going to let my colleagues provide the solutions.
Well, John, do you want to follow on that?
Sure. Is this on? Or do I have to push a button? So
it's on. I think you're on.
Okay. Well, it's a pleasure and a privilege to be here. Thanks for to the Federalist Society for inviting me. I was shocked that more people weren't here on this very broad topic of keen interest, but I'm glad all of you are here. I'm sure you are interested, so I'm privileged to be here. So I think generally, Todd gave some of the historical perspective. I was just going to try to give an overview of what, I think are sort of the current events that are creating some challenges and headwinds for the banking industry, so I can sort of provide that perspective. And then I think Will is going to talk about some of the developments on the fair access side. But I mean, the topic of the panel sort of surprised me, whether the National Bank Charter has lost its usefulness or its utility. I certainly hope not. The National Bank Charter, I think along with state charter options, this is really the bedrock of the U.S. financial system. The National Charter and the state charter complement each other very well, both significant historical roots. In this country, we have charter choice. It's a key feature of our system. I think our U.S. banking system is probably the best in the world, if not one of the best, and the dual banking system is a key reason for that. And as we get into all these debates and argue about some of the things we're happy or not happy about with banking, I always think it's important for us to just remember that at its foundation, the banks exist to power the economy, frankly. And if they didn't do that, then I'm not sure they would serve much usefulness. They do that by empowering consumers, empowering business, providing financing, providing safekeeping of assets and cash, and providing efficient payment rails. But with respect to the National Charter in particular, the key benefit really is just to, and Todd touched on this, but to provide a uniform set of national rules and standards that ultimately yield efficiencies that benefit, I think, both consumers and American business. You sort of ask that question, well, what is a uniform set of standards? The national banks are quite heavily regulated by the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency under the National Bank Act. There are multiple federal statutes designed to govern banks in this country, and those statutes apply, frankly, to federally chartered banks as well as state banks. But what does that mean to have a uniform set of national standards? I mean, as it's developed in the case law and been enshrined in the statute, it is that those banks subject to the uniform standards will enjoy preemption from state laws that prevent or significantly interfere with the bank's exercise of its powers. And there are the many benefits of preemption, by the way, and not a lot of people talk about this, including my friends at the Conference of State Bank Supervisors, many of the benefits of sort of federal preemption and promotion of uniform national standards really were made also available to state banks and the state charter through various provisions of federal law, most importantly the Regal-Neal Interstate Branching Act of 1994, which sought to modernize and remove a lot of the sort of archaic and anti-competitive moats that had been built around various local banks. And that statute conferred preemption privileges on state banks with respect to their operations out of state. So if you're chartered in New York and you have a branch in Florida, your branch in Florida enjoys preemption of Florida law to the same extent as if the bank were a national bank. And there's actually recent case law on that. It was a case involving Regions Bank. There was actually Florida's a good example. There was a law that I think prohibited state banks from charging check cashing fees. And J.P. Morgan, a national bank, challenged that. Court decided, I think it went up to the circuit court, decided that that significantly interfered with J.P. Morgan's exercise of its powers and was declared preempted with respect to national banks. Then a class action lawsuit was brought against Regions Bank, which is a state chartered bank that has branches, has branches in Florida, and was a class action brought against them for violation of the same Florida state law, and the circuit court confirmed the district court's decision that that Florida law was preempted with respect to the local region's operations because it was an out-of-state bank and it enjoyed the same federal preemptions. So when we talk about, like, has the national charter lost its usefulness, you know, a national charter and a state charter, yes, there are some differences. The differences are not, like, radically stark anymore, honestly. The main difference is just who your supervisor is. So there's a lot of sort of supervisory arbitrage that banks sort of engage in. By the way, once you pick a charter, it's not very easy to switch charters. Some organizations do it. You have to make a real commitment, and it's a tough slog. But if you're going for a new charter and you're trying to decide between a state charter and a federal charter, you just have to decide, do you want to live with the OCC as your forced marriage spouse with no annulment and divorce? Or do you want to choose the state banking commissioner in the state of your choice? And by the way, that's not your only choice. If you choose your state banking commissioner, you're still signing up for federal supervision and examination. The FDIC will be your primary federal regulator and examiner. And you will be required to have deposit insurance, as all deposit taking institutions are in this country are for more or less. You'll be required to have deposit insurance. And so you're going to be subject to all the federal laws that apply to federal to national banks, more or less, right? Your powers will still be derived from state law, but for more or less, all these banks are pretty much regulated and examined the same way. So anyway, when we have this debate, it's not like if you get rid of the national charter, we'll all just live with state charters. I mean, it's I don't know. In any event, I think it's kind of a little bit of a red herring to talk about this distinction of the national charter in some respects. But in any event, the key issue, I think, is what does it mean for preemption purposes and sort of the true usefulness of the national bank charter. It's obviously federal preemption. As I said, state banks enjoy it too. But for national banks, clearly that's one of the main advantages of that particular charter. But the key issue then is what does it mean to prevent or significantly interfere with, you know, the exercise of your powers, your national bank powers? What are those powers? Obviously, at their core in the National Bank Act from 1864, it is basically lending, deposit taking, and payments. But it's also other things. And what are those other things? It's things, honestly, that the OCC has decided over the years. You know, the OCC interprets its own authorizing statute, the National Bank Act, and over the years, the OCC has interpreted the powers granted by the National Bank Act to mean many things outside of what's in the statute. And here, there are obviously probably going to be new questions about how much deference the OCC will get with respect to its decision-making on what some of those powers are. If someone were to challenge the ability of national banks to engage in certain powers that the OCC has authorized by regulation, I suppose a judge could look at that and perhaps decide in a post-Loper-Bright world that they want to do a more in-depth examination of whether those powers are truly authorized by the National Bank Act and to what deference the court would afford to the OCC's regulations that were developed to implement those powers. But largely, like my own view, of course, which is not unbiased, is that the OCC has largely just kept pace with advancements in innovations, including technological innovations, going back to the ATM as a major technological advancement to these days. You know, banks are looking at a lot of things, right? AI, tokenization, distributed ledger, et cetera. All intended to deliver products and services to their consumer and business customers in a way that's efficient. And quite frankly, to compete with a lot of institutions that are engaging in activities that look an awful lot like banking, but where these organizations have opted not to get a bank charter. And so this is sort of the shadow bank system, whether it's crypto these days or prepaid cards or whatever any of these developments are. Banks are constantly trying to keep pace and compete with these other providers on what I would regard as sort of an unlevel playing field. All of this, while the bank charter confers privileges, it also confers burdens and costs. So, and by the way, as the OCC has developed these new powers for national banks over the years, the states are not dumb. They caught up. We do have charter choice. If you don't like if the OCC charter is vastly superior to your state bank charter, you're probably going to seriously consider whether you should flip. So the states got wise to this. They started enacting these wild card statutes that basically said, look, if the OCC approves something for national banks, it's automatically deemed approved for a state bank in our state. And so, again, sort of making sure that the charters are able to compete with each other. All right, so that's bank powers. But then what does it mean to significantly interfere with the bank powers? The OCC also has developed over the years regulations, has identified a dozen or so state laws that it would deem to be preempted by the National Bank Act. And in addition, the courts obviously have spent decades looking at this question of whether particular state laws would be preempted under the National Bank Act. This has all sort of culminated recently and into what we hoped would be like a focal point of absolute clarity, but that has not happened. and I will just briefly touch on why that hasn't happened and I think what we think what the next steps are going to be. So obviously, as Todd's talked about, the Barnett standard, which is the standard that came out of a Florida case about whether banks could sell insurance in small towns, the OCC said yes, the Florida law said no, and the court in Barnett said that the state law, the Florida law, was preempted in that case and developed sort of a methodology for basing that decision. More recently, obviously, we have the Quintero decision, which has been discussed, which is a Second Circuit case, a New York law that requires banks to pay interest on mortgage interest escrow. New York is not alone. There are many states in the country that do this. California has such a law. I believe Connecticut has such a law. Many others. These are the three states that have where those laws are sort of under active litigation. But Quintero is obviously the most important because it's the most recent and comes from the Supreme Court. I think depending on who you talk to, you might get a slightly different view on what Quintero means for national bank preemption, and maybe Will has a different view. So it's controlling, but it doesn't resolve everything. The bottom line is I think people were hoping for a bright line test, and they didn't get it. In Quintero, the Supreme Court held that state law is preempted, obviously, if it interferes in a manner akin to past interference cases where the Supreme Court found preemption, including Barnett. So they kind of said, hey, everybody, look at what we've already done. That should be clear enough, which I don't think everybody totally agrees with. But in Quintero, I think the Supreme Court did provide some additional direction for judges at the trial or appellate court level to look at a preemption analysis that's been done or to conduct a preemption analysis. And they say that the analysis should be a nuanced comparative analysis, comparing the state law, again, to laws and prior Supreme Court precedents, including Barnett and others. Quintero actually listed some of the prior cases that they thought there should be a proper comparative analysis to. They also said that the analysis should entail a practical assessment of the state law, looking at past precedent. The court should also look at a law's text and structure, and should also utilize common sense to decide if the state law should be preempted. So, no bright line test. They sent Quintero back to the Second Circuit. My own view on this is, my own view on this is that comparative analysis is clear with respect to these mortgage interest law, mortgage escrow interest laws, and the common sense is clear to me at least, but I'm gonna acknowledge that my view is not universally shared, and I think reasonable minds, frankly, could sort of disagree. And so it will be interesting to see these courts wrestle with Quintero's direction for them to engage in this nuanced comparative analysis. And the status in Quintero is it's back in the Second Circuit, and briefing is occurring. Quintero is very interesting procedurally, because when the Supreme Court decided to take up Quintero, it declined to hear an appeal on essentially a nearly identical case from the Ninth Circuit, which has been mentioned, Kivett v. Flagstar Bank. And there the issue is whether a California mortgage escrow interest law is preempted by the National Bank Act.
Well, that's obviously because the Ninth Circuit was correctly decided. That's the inference, right?
And here, hopefully,
no
we
comment.
Can agree that reasonable minds can disagree. But I do think procedurally this is very interesting. I mean, it's setting up, I think, you know, another circuit split. We're just gonna have to watch and see if these matters go right back up to the Supreme Court. In any event, I don't want to offer any predictions, but this Kivik case was interesting. So when the Supreme Court sent Quintero back to the Second Circuit, they simultaneously remanded Kivik, which they did not hear or issue an opinion on. They sent it back to the Ninth Circuit, and they said, in Kivik, they said the Ninth Circuit, should review it in the context of the new standard developed in Quintero. And so the Ninth Circuit immediately and without post-remand briefing issued an opinion that was unpublished, I think two or three lines, saying that Quintero confirmed the Ninth Circuit's previous opinion in Luznak, which was another prior case in the Ninth Circuit over the California law, and on which Kivik was largely, their decision in Kivik was largely based. And as the Ninth Circuit said, look, Quintero confirmed that we were right in Luznak. We relied on Luznak to decide in Kivik. The case closed. It's done. What they didn't do, though, my own personal view, I was surprised that the Ninth Circuit did not undertake Quintero's nuanced comparative analysis. So setting Kivik aside, Flagstar has now petitioned for an en banc review in the Ninth Circuit, and I think the Ninth Circuit has asked for additional briefing from the parties, and that's where it stands procedurally. Also, I mentioned there's this case in the First Circuit, Conti versus Citizens. That's also in briefing, no decision. But you have these three cases that, in my own view, these circuits are looking at the exact same issue, the same law, the same state laws. And I guess you just have to think about what are the implications of these three, if these three cases are resolved with different outcomes in the various circuits. Now, I know it's not like this doesn't happen every once in a while, but will the matter go back before the Supreme Court? Will the Supreme Court be asked to develop additional guidance, perhaps a bright line test? It is interesting to think that you could have these different outcomes, both for banks, but also for consumers. How can a California mortgage escrow interest law, entitled to a consumer to some protection, but that same consumer traveling to Connecticut is not enjoy sort of the same protection under the Connecticutlaw. I don't know if a quote-unquote brighter line test from the Supreme Court would be a better test, certainly from my own perspective, and maybe other people's perspectives as well. I'll try to wrap up here quickly. I just want to highlight a couple other key issues. We haven't talked about it much, but it's going to be relevant when we talk about what the state AGs are thinking and doing. But it's alongside preemption sits the OCC's exclusive visitorial authority to examine the books and records of national banks. And basically, unless federal law otherwise authorizes, this exclusive visitorial authority means that no state or local officials may examine or demand the production of a national bank's books and records. And that'll come back in a little bit. So the main things that are going on, in addition to Quintero and these other two cases that need to be decided, there are these state fair access laws that I know Will is going to address. And he'll probably talk about the policy rationale underlying them, so I'll defer to him on that. There's a Florida law that's been enacted, and there's also a law in Tennessee. The Tennessee law, in a politically astute way, applies only to banks with more than $100 billion of assets. That is the least politically favored class of banking institutions in the country.
Rightly so.
And it's largely similar to a quote-unquote, we call these things fair access because there's a new provision in the Section 1 of the National Bank Act that was added by Dodd-Frank, which effectively says the OCC has a comptroller, and the comptroller shall do a number of things. And in Dodd-Frank, they said one of those things should also be to ensure fair access to financial services, that national banks are providing fair access to financial services. And the people who put that provision in the law were intending to, I think, ensure that national banks were serving consumers of all socioeconomic and racial backgrounds in the country. But it's in there, and it's those two words. In the prior administration, Brian Brooks, an acting comptroller, at the end of the prior Trump administration, had developed a regulation that he had actually finalized, but never went to the Federal Register, or it did go to the Federal Register, and it never got published, so it never became legally effective. And it could become legally effective very soon, because I think it's still collecting dust on a shelf at the OCC, and could probably be sent to the Federal Register. But it's very, so the Florida law is very similar to the Brian Brooks Fair Access law in the prior administration. The Florida law basically says that banks, all banks, right, not just Florida banks, not just Florida state charter banks or other state charter banks, but all banks operating in Florida, including Florida branches or federally chartered branches of non-U.S. banks in Florida, of which there are many, that these banks can consider only qualitative, impartial, and risk-based data when making decisions about customers, whether it's to bank a customer or to provide credit or some product or service. Florida law says it's an unsafe and an unsound practice to do otherwise, and that they also banks can't consider social credit scores. It also sets up a customer complaint process, and these details are boring but important for the legal analysis. It sets up a customer complaint process where a consumer who feels aggrieved can file a complaint with the state. Then the Florida, it demands that a Florida administrative agency engage in an investigative process once it's in receipt of the complaint, and it also requires the bank to file an attestation requirement from some lucky executive under penalty of perjury. So far, I don't think any complaints have been filed, at least none that the public is aware of, none that I'm aware of. I've heard murmurs, but there's been nothing public about a complaint. You know, a number of the banks that operate in Florida, of course, concerned about this, right, and watching this very closely. So that's, I think, where the state fair access laws are. The footnote to that, which I'm sure Will talk about, is, you know, in the current in the incoming administration, you might see these state fair access law issues dissipate because there could be a federal fair access law, which would moot a lot of the state issues. The other live matter are the states are enacting, or at least one state has enacted and two other states are considering enacting these debit interchange laws. And this is just rooted in the ongoing, ever-ending battle between the merchants and the banks about credit card and debit interchange fees. These are fees that are charged effectively to merchants in connection with consumers using credit cards or debit cards at point of sale. And those fees largely like support the payments infrastructure that underpins debit and credit card. In Illinois, they've done this. The law prohibits the charging of those interchange fees on the tip and tax portion of purchases. As I said, I think there's a law coming in Pennsylvania on the same thing. The ABA and the Illinois Bankers Association have sued, claiming federal preemption. The OCC has filed an amicus supporting the complaint, claiming that the Illinois law is preempted under the National Bank Act, which was a surprise, like, frankly, to the banking industry that happened. And the last thing is the state AGs. We've talked about it. So, and some of these are red state AGs, and some of these are blue state AGs, but I think mostly blue state AGs. They are engaged in an effort to overcome the OCC's exclusive visitorial authority. The key judicial precedent on that, by the way, is the Clearinghouse v. Cuomo, and it basically says that state AGs can bring actions against banks, national banks, in courts to enforce state law, but they cannot examine a bank or demand books and record production from the bank. And Dodd-Frank actually codified that Cuomo standard. Congress codified that Cuomo standard in Dodd-Frank. But recently, the state AGs, in what appears to be a highly coordinated effort, not just between and amongst themselves, but with what I would characterize as the progressive parts of the Biden administration. Maybe this room thinks there aren't non-progressive parts of the Biden administration, but there are certainly, in my view, more progressive parts. There's a coordinated effort, and a letter was submitted by these state AGs, both to the acting comptroller of the currency in the Biden administration, as well as the CFPB director, basically claiming that they want more access to banks' books and records, and they're not happy with banks, national banks, who are declining to produce those books and records and who are declining to consent to the state attorney general's efforts to come examine those books and records. They're upset that the banks are asserting their legal right by saying that the OCC has the exclusive right to do such things. The CFPB responded in what I would personally characterize as a highly ill-reasoned way, and said that they were very concerned that the banks were asserting this their federal rights, and that they would start basically dinging banks for if they were not complying with state AG requests for access to books and records. My own view is the CFPB's letter and the CFPB director's understanding of the law, as well as his general counsel, that they have misconstrued visitorial powers. They have conflated it with federal preemption, and while these two issues are related, they should not be conflated. The last thoughts are just, and hopefully we'll talk about this, and I apologize if I run on too long, but you know, I do have some views on like where this is going, or where this could go, where you sort of have this bifurcated blue state, red state approach to banking in this country, which I do not think would be good, to use like a charge term. You know, it would be the balkanization of banking in this country potentially, I think to the detriment of the economy, to economic growth, both for business and consumers. The fate of preemption in this incoming administration is highly unclear. The new comptroller will be very determinative on where this goes. Personnel is clearly going to be policy here. Going into the future, my own view is I hope we can figure out a way to preserve the charter choice. But again, I think like from a legal perspective, the charter choice, there aren't major legal distinctions. There really are just these distinctions about who your supervisor is. And maybe there are these issues about when banks close accounts. And these are very legitimate concerns. There's a lot of people who have been raising these concerns. They sort of, their account is closed and they get no explanation. That is clearly a major, major problem. The banks have tried unsuccessfully, I think, to explain sort of why this happens. There are federal laws that I think tie the bank's hands and make it illegal for them to share any information about why they're closing those banks. I think more transparency needs to be brought to that process, because I think it's inciting a lot of justified anger and annoyance with no good answers. And that's it. Thank you.
That was quite the tour de force. Very impressive, very impressive. Fairly brief, because I know we want to leave time for Q&A, and thank you, John, for that incredible table setting. Just to do a little table setting of my own before I get into my remarks and feelings on this, I actually, maybe surprise you, I share your inclination and desire towards a national banking market, as you kind of talked about. It's not just the idea of whether national banking charters have outlived their usefulness, it's whether the national banking market will become balkanized. And I think it is a tragedy that the national banking market is on its way to becoming balkanized, and I'm one of the people doing it. One of the things that I think wasn't mentioned in my intro is that I run the nation's oldest consumer protection organization, and what we've done since I've taken over the last 4 or 5 years is go after woke capitalism and ESG. And the banking industry itself has been one of the worst practitioners of this. I think that, you know, lest you think you're up here having a Jacobin speak to you, I think that the Dormant Commerce Clause and the fact that the United States has historically been the greatest free trade zone in the world has been a big reason why we've been so successful. And I think I actually agree with both in the metaphorical sense, which you meant it, John, that the bank's business is to power American capitalism, and both in the literal sense, given what they are doing in the publicly traded utility market, what they are doing in with net zero, is that they are abrogating their job to literally power amongst other industries that they are trying to regulate through their membership in things like Net Zero Banking Alliance and Glasgow Financial Alliance for Net Zero. So I am not without sympathy towards those who would like to see the market stay together. I think that would be better for the country, which is why, as I will articulate, I find it rather mystifying that the banking industry as a whole, but certainly the top five, JP Morgan, Citi, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, and U.S. Bank, although slightly less a guilty U.S. Bank, seem so hell-bent on turning themselves into political utilities, which sets up a game theory a conundrum within game theory, let's say, that leads red states and red actors no choice. Their only way is to defect from the market, to use things like fair access laws and rules that would take certain states away from these banks as customers, not as regulators, but many states have passed laws that would prevent states like Texas, West Virginia, Tennessee, and I think we're up to 18 or 19 now, that would say, listen, if you are targeting with your loan portfolio policies, the riders that you're putting into your finance agreements, if you were targeting key industries in our state, and that varies. In some, it's oil and gas, but it's much broader than that. It can be guns. In other words, it can be both economic but also based around rights. If you're doing those things, that includes also fair access if you're, you know, booting out people like Ambassador Brownback, then we are no longer going to do business with you as a state. And I think the banks rightly see that as a precursor, both as an aggressive action towards what they're doing, but also as a precursor that they're going to be going up the drawing board every legislative session and seeing what new ideas they can come up with. Many of them I might help provide them on ways that they can push back on what I think is a really obnoxious and odious breakdown in our national unity. So, as Professor Zawicki mentioned, some of this started, and some of the bank's defense has been that this has been partly the action of regulators, and we saw with Operation Choke Point that they were certainly encouraged to go along with the sort of political utilization of the banks to choke off finance and capital and even access to disfavored industries, guns, fireworks, payday lenders. And while I'm sympathetic to any industry that obviously faces a hostile regulatory environment, I do think, and I this isn't an illegal argument, this is more of a moral and nationalistic one, we wouldn't be a country if people hadn't have stood up against the tyranny of regulators and government, even when it would have been easier to go along with it. And it took, in our case, very much members of the business community saying that what you're doing to the citizens of this country is not right, and we are not going to go along with it. We're not going to cave just because it would be easier to do so. So I find very unsympathetic their arguments that, listen, don't come at us, come at the federal government, come at the regulators who are doing this, get them off their back. The second reason I find that very unsympathetic is they seem to be going far and above what they're even being asked to do. So I've mentioned membership in things like the Net Zero Banking Alliance. This is a consortium, in my opinion, it's a cartel. Of bankers. It's part of a silo of a broader organization that has memberships. Like, there's a Net Zero Asset Managers. There was until me and some state AGs helped blow it up, a Net Zero Insurers Alliance, that basically have committed to using their market power collectively and colluding with each other to push net zero as a economic policy here in the United States across pretty much every industry. That includes airlines, that includes fossil fuels, that includes publicly traded utilities. It gets into specifics, including things like pushing publicly traded utilities to set specific early retirement dates on every coal and natural gas plant that they own. So this is getting not just into a general policy, which in of itself would be odious, it gets into the micromanagement of the businesses. And these are things that, while I agree, I think the banking industry in the United States is the far and away the best in the world, I don't believe that gives people like Jamie Dimon and Brian Moynihan the right to claim that they know how to run a publicly traded utility better than the CEOs of those companies, or an airline better than those companies, or a steel company better than those companies, or a coal company, as we found when another member of GFANS, BlackRock, and I know I'm taking a quick pot shot at my beta noir, BlackRock, they told their clients that they were divesting them, many of them public pensioners, so this was something they were doing with public pension dollars, divesting them of coal because it was going to be a what it's called orphaned asset. It was going to be go to zero because of all of the net zero policies that were going to be enacted in the United States. They missed out on 1,400% gains after the breakout of the Ukraine war and the reliance of Europe and Germany in particular on increased coal imports. So allowing politics to shade one's business decisions can be hurtful, obviously, for one's own business. But what I think is really sad is that it's not that the national banking market has outlived its usefulness, or the national bank charter has outlived its usefulness. It's being killed. It's being killed by people who have a choice to do otherwise. And I think we're getting pretty close to Q&A time, so I'll stop there. I can go into some of the details. I've got nice screenshots from their websites. They were very happy to brag about all the activities they were engaging in, which is fairly surprising given the effects that it's having. And I do think that I'll just close by saying that regardless of the legal arguments, I'm not trying to sidestep those, and John, I'm sure you've got very nuanced views that probably beat the crap out of mine. There is simply the game theory that you're not going to have two-thirds of the states of the country have be dictated to by five banking CEOs about how their economy is going to run and what rights they're going to be able to exercise. And I would just add to the history of banking, one more recent addition is that while it would have been bad enough to, you know, in the 1800s or the early 1900s to be ostracized from banking, at that point, banking was basically storage. You were either putting specie, metals, or you were putting, you know, in the fiat currency age, you were putting dollars in a store so that no one could break into your house and steal it. Banking in this day and age is much more like having an address or not having one. If you cannot send and receive money, you basically don't exist to the system. I think we've all probably, especially around DC, gone into places that do not take cash, and that is going to increase as obviously that becomes more convenient and it reduces crime because you obviously can't do stick-ups if there's no cash on hand. So I would say the fair access issue as well really highlights in priority, even more so than it would have in the 1800s or the early 1900s, because you really almost cannot operate in society, much like not having an ID, if you do not have a banking account. So I'll stop there and we can debate or not debate or see wherever we're ever.
Thank you. Thank you all. Maybe before we go into questions, I mean, Professor Zwick has been sitting here listening to everyone else. Do you want to take 2 or 3 minutes and maybe we'll go back around and respond to anything that's been said?
No, I don't have anything.
Okay. John, do you want to take a shot at defending what you just heard from Will, or should we just go into questions?
No, I mean, look, I think a lot of what Will says, like, makes a lot of sense. You know, he's got more factual, I think, insight into how some of these customers like feel like they have been treated. I can't speak to that. I don't have that factual insight. Clearly, the notion that, you know, if you are in this country and you know here lawfully, and whether that is as an individual or a business, you're engaged in lawful activities, the notion that you would be cut off from the financial system because of political judgments about your behavior, even if it's lawful, I don't think that has like a good true ring to it. And so, to the extent that that is happening, you know, that's a problem. I do think the market. I do sometimes wonder how, like, real and tangible that problem is. I mean, what you're talking about, if a bank won't give you a loan unless you promise to shut down your plant by some fixed date. I'm unaware of that, obviously. I you know, that seems like it would be concerning. But I do think the, you know, sometimes, you know, the if you walk into one bread store and you don't like their bread or they don't like you, I don't know, maybe you walk into the other bread store. Same thing with clothing. I mean, with banking, I mean, you know, people like to say that there isn't much competition in banking. I don't believe that at all. You know, if you're looking for financial services in this country and you can't find someone to provide them, that would be an interesting case to examine. And I think it's probably rare. But that being said, I don't have, you know, that's just my perception. I don't have the facts on some of these things. And to the extent that's going on, I agree that's concerning.
Yeah, I would just add to that, and thank you, John, because I jogged my memory on a couple points that I forgot to bring up. The first is that I understand the banks have, and they pushed back to me personally when I brought this up with them, the issues around some of the people that they claim claim that they were debanked for political reasons. They've claimed that it was a little bit more complicated than that, and there were some paperwork issues or KYC issues or something like that. The issue we've got, I would be much more inclined to buy that if the banks weren't engaging in political utilization for the Democratic Party in so many other areas. And I think this is somewhat, I admit this is somewhat unfair, but I do think it's from a people's perception perspective, it just simply is what it is. You've seen the weaponization of the banking industry in a number of other Anglosphere countries that I think weighs heavily on people's perception. So namely, what happened to Nigel Farage. He was debanked. They told him it was for non-political reasons. He could not find a number, any other banks that, you know, again, there's plenty of competition in the banking industry in the UK. There's dozens of them, if not hundreds. And yet, each one, he was denied. And thankfully, due to the frankly incompetence of the CEO of the bank that he was debanked from, she leaked some of his personal documents in order to defend herself from those accusations. And it became clear through the the then investigation that not only had they debanked him for political reasons, there were emails, traffic showing this, that then they had tried to penalize him when he complained. So I and then we also saw with the truckers protest in Canada, that was another situation which I don't think the international banking industry, and again, I know that's not who you're representing here today, but I think the international banking industry, the Canadian one at least, really showed themselves to be cowards and petty tyrants and went after these people and even prevented them from donate from people who wanted to give to them to help them through this situation as they exercised what I believe to be their human right to protest their government. They were debanked and then even doxed, have their personal information listed. And so I am sympathetic to an individual case where banks have, you know, been in a position where for whatever reason they were not able to provide someone banking and it had nothing to do with some sort of political or racial or otherwise discriminatory situation. They're not able to defend themselves. That said, that's why it's so important that banks run as far away. And the Bible says, flee even the appearance of evil. The banks, I think, are going to find themselves suffering for their other sins on this issue of fair access if they don't get themselves together on net zero and weighing in on political issues, especially the way Bank of America has and Brian Moynihan been very vocal about.
Okay. I will just chime in on this. Let me ask a show of hands. You remember there's this big controversy when PayPal said they were going to fine people $2,500 for spreading misinformation. And then they said that was an accident. How many people in this room think that was just an accident? How many people think that they knew what they were putting in their policy? Right? Some of this stuff doesn't pass the straight face test. I think there is a problem here with debanking, and the problem is the I won't belabor because we've talked about this previously, but the problem is the opaque way in which supervision and regulation occurs and examination occurs in the banking system. If you ever want to hear sort of the story, there is available on the internet a recording of a conversation between Mike Lindell's comptroller and the bank that they had traditionally banked Mike Lindell and his charities and the business when the bank told them they were closing his account. And the comptroller said, well, what happens if we don't voluntarily close our account? And the comptroller and then the bank said, well, in 30 days, we'll have to close your account involuntarily, and then you get put on the bad boy list. And apparently the bad boy list, it's not clear what the bad boy list is, but basically it would blackball him from getting any bank account anywhere. So when you hear about voluntary bank closures, I think that's what's going on. And what's resting behind this is this comprehensive system of supervision, examination, and the like. And people just don't want to talk about it when they get debanked because I think they're afraid that they're not going to be able to get a bank account somewhere else for making too much trouble because we all know how this works behind the scenes. Or as John Allison said, it's regulation by raised eyebrow. Do you really need to give that guy a bank account? Is that really a good idea for your business, right? And the last thing I'll say is what was run during that process, right? And they weren't just infringing on political rights. They were debanking firearms dealers, it seems, who have Second Amendment rights, purveyors of so-called racist materials, who have First Amendment materials. In Canada, they said you can have bail, but you can't, but your bank account is frozen, so you don't have any money to post your bail, right? These sorts of things. But it was really the prototype for the social media censorship racket that the White House was running, just using the vague threats of the regulatory state to basically get, quote, voluntary compliance from companies on these things. We all know the government just doesn't make suggestions to private businesses. We all know what happens when they say it's a good idea to do something. And so I think it's really important that I think this stuff probably is going on. It's not just solved necessarily by competition. And I think it's important to take affirmative steps to find out exactly what's going on.
And if I could just ask very briefly, because I know we want to get to questions, I also want to make sure that people don't walk away with the impression that it's only situations where the government, like what's happened with social media or in banking, gives you a call, raised eyebrow, do you really need to do this? What I find to be very alarming is that there are situations where banks have gone above and beyond to kick people off of financing for goals that have not been dictated to. There's no even indication that regulators have done so. So if one example has been a gentleman named Bud Brigham, who run a junior wildcatter oil operation in Texas. And he had a line of credit with a bank called Credit Suisse for years, which I'm glad to say is out of business because they suck. And at one point, he went to go renew his line of credit, and they contacted him and said, listen, because you're in the oil industry, you have exceeded you're hurting our ESG quotas within our bank portfolio, which, again, that's not been enacted in the United States. That's something that banks have voluntarily chosen when they join the Net Zero Bank Alliance cartel to take on. They said, though, if, and thank goodness the bureaucrat working at the bank was so stupid to put this in writing, they said, if you were to tweet out, though, a bunch from your personal and from your business accounts, a bunch of what we're going to send you about the need for actions on net zero and climate action, then we could qualify the lending that we give to your company within our ESG portfolio. This was done in writing. It's been testified multiple times in front of Texas legislature. So it's not that is also a problem, and it's a very big problem. And it may have even been where this problem originated. But banks have taken that, and probably staff that they hired during the Operation Choke Point to help them deal with that, have now see their job as to go above and beyond and enact environmental and social policy through the banking system. And as I say, it's not just the government, you know, twisting their arm. They have now decided they enjoy doing this.
Well, let me just follow up on this question. We've seemed to identify a problem that, even John says is problematic. What is the answer to this? Does this come, do we need congressional action? Can this come through regulatory action? How much can competition play a role in sort of reining this in?
Yeah, I certainly think, I'm hopeful that under the next administration, both the state and the federal governments can work together to get rid of this. There's certainly been federal fair access banking drafts written to varying degrees of quality, in my opinion. But also, just the retrenchment of a lot of what the Biden administration was doing to try and politicize, not just the bank industry, frankly, every industry, but certainly they were using every, OCC, FDIC, the Fed. I used to joke that we're going to find out the Bureau of Printing and Engraving is going to come out with pro-climate change regulations any day now. Only half joking, really, because they all had a climate czar. So I think one of it is retrenching, but also I think punishing some of these companies that have engaged in this. Glasgow Financial Alliance for Net Zero and the Net Zero Banking Alliance is a public agreement signed by the CEOs of these banks on a website where they claim they're going to, one, utilize their market share to choke off financing to industries that won't play ball and coordinate with each other across the industry to do that. So it's like 40% of the banking industry is a signatory to this. And in addition to that, they have agreed as part of this to let UNEP, the United Nations Environmental Program, audit their loan portfolios to make sure they are engaging in the cartel. So you actually have an enforcement mechanism for the cartel, which any economist will tell you is like crucial for keeping it together because there's always a incentive to defect. So it's almost stunning. There's a psychological theory where if you're going to do something really bad, you almost want to do something so outrageous that no one will believe that it's happening. And I think GFANS falls into that category.
I'll add on that. I think that's why I talk so much about horizontal vertical federalism, which is understanding what's legitimate state enforcement and the like, what is federal. I think it's absurd, for example, the idea that the New York AG thinks they have something to say about the Discover Capital One merger, which is if there's anything that's clearly completely interstate and New York has no business weighing in on. That seems like it to me from an antitrust perspective. I think it's equally valid to say that Florida has a valid state right to protect, to under their unfair and deceptive practices, to prevent people from being debanked on the basis of their political views. I also agree with John that the first line of defense is competition and offering competition, but financial services, I think, raises particular concerns that may not be raised somewhere else, like a cake baker or something, right? Which is, you do have this comprehensive system, you have this very opaque, non-rule of law sort of system of regulation through supervision and examination and all this stuff behind closed doors. as John says, for very good, there's actually reasons why they don't tell you why you're being debanked. So if you were a terrorist, for example, we don't say, hey, we're debanking you because you think you're engaged in terrorism and money laundering, right? And that's kind of how they're, what they're applying to these people. And so I think transparency is an important part of that. But I think there are lines that can be drawn if you have a coherent understanding of what is federal, what is traditionally part of this, what is a legitimate role for states, and where does competition work and where does competition break down. And I think my concern is because of the way regulation is done and because of the comprehensive ability of the federal regulators to limit entry into the business of banking and basically force everybody to abide by the same rules, freedom of entry and access doesn't work as well here perhaps as it does in other markets.
Okay, well, why don't we've got some people lined up for questions. Why don't we go over here to a question at the microphone first?
Sure, so J.W. Verrett, I teach with Todd at George Mason Law School. So I have a debanking story and a question. So my debanking story is, so I've been a Bank of America customer for 15 years, personally and from my expert witness consulting LLC. So I started a little nonprofit. I called it the Crypto Freedom Lab. The idea was get some money from donors and support some papers by academics about problems like debanking of crypto, right? So I go to Bank of America and I say, hey, I just started a nonprofit. Here's the LLC. Can I get a bank account? Okay, what's the name? The Crypto Freedom Lab. Ooh, we can't do that. And I said, wait, you mean I'm sitting here to get a bank account for my nonprofit that's going to write about the problem of debanking of crypto, and you're telling me I can't get a bank account for that nonprofit? I mean, first, thank you, because this is going to be great in the fundraising calls going forward, right? This is going to be perfect. I went to five other banks, big banks. Same deal. Actually, I found a credit union that was like, no problem. I think the debanking problem is actually, this part of this story, has not been as bad at credit unions. Because they've not been as much a part of this problem. So it was a great story. And just another one. So just a month or two ago, I tried to register for the Blockchain Association's annual meeting. Right, so I use my credit card. Doesn't go through.
Oh, man.
So I call, hey, fraud department. Yeah, this was a legit. I really wanted to register for the Blockchain Association's annual meeting where the bank regulators come and speak to crypto founders. Try it again. Wait, can you stay in line with me? Yeah, it didn't go through again. Try it again. Oh, is this for a crypto thing? We can't process that. I'm sorry, your card can't be used to process crypto. I said, I'm not even buying crypto, which should be okay. I'm just trying to register for a meeting that has blockchain in the name of the trade association. Sorry, we can't process that. So that's what we're dealing with here, which is amazing to me. But so that's my story. It helped me personally for getting the word out about this problem. But so as much as the SEC and the CFTC have been a problem, kind of a war on crypto, twisting regulation to try to kill that industry, the problem on the banking regulatory side and CFPB side has been limited to debanking, choke point 2.0, right? Which is a big problem that needs to be fixed. But I was always worried the CFPB and the banking regulators would be used in worse ways, that the CFPB would say you're not compliant with this or that fair lending regulation requirement that smart contract protocols can't possibly comply with, or that you're operating an unlicensed bank because you're doing lending to retail, even though smart contract lending is very different from anything a bank would do. That never actually happened, maybe just because they didn't get around to it. But how do we prevent that from happening in the future? In other words, what sort of ideas can we develop that combine preemption with some sort of whether it's a fintech sandboxes, which we talked about in the last Trump administration, sandbox plus preemption, exemptive relief plus preemption on the CFPB and banking regulator side. What sort of options are on the table to cement some of that stuff to prevent abuse of those agencies against crypto in the next Democrat administration? That's my question.
I'll just answer briefly. I'm not going to talk about any specifics. You could talk to Paul Watkins about sandboxes in the Trump administration. But I do think what this points up is I think that, let's take central bank digital currency, for example. Fortunately, President-elect Trump has talked about banning CBDC, attacking debanking and the like. But I think what we have learned is that we need to pass affirmative laws that tell the these deep state institutions. You cannot do that, right? A lot of people say, oh, we don't need to worry about CBDC because the Fed has no authority to issue CBDC. They have no authority to do X. Doesn't mean they're not going
to
do it.
Tell that to the corporate bond market in 2020.
Yeah, right.
That they intervened in.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah. And so I think the lesson is that we need to cement into legislation, preferably perhaps regulation, a clear lines that tell regulators in this area what they cannot do. So a fair access rule is good. A fair access law is better. A formal law that says you may not issue central bank digital currency. You may not drag crypto into the banking system, which is what they want to do so that they can control it, all these sorts of things. Set up a different system. But I think the lesson is we need to actually put up affirmative walls around what they can do, because otherwise they'll stretch to the breaking point and beyond.
Why don't we go here?
Hi, Harry Lewis from New York. I'm in the belly of the beast, as we say. I'm reminded of the very first statute passed by the Texas legislature at a time when Texas, of course, was a state that was comprised of debtors fleeing their creditors. And that statute basically outlawed the creation of banks or lending at interest, which was certainly an early policy solution to this entire issue, correct? But no. The notion of having, say, a Republican bank versus a Democrat bank doesn't particularly offend me, assuming, of course, you know, one bank says we're only going to lend to Republicans. The other bank says we're only going to lend to Democrats, right? It, as a policy matter, that doesn't offend me as long as consumers have the choice to go to the other bank. So it seems to be one of the sort of underlying questions here is concentration in financial services, where you've got these enormous, just gigantic, and small-time banks are still consolidating and, you know, struggling and failing, and more, you know, economic power is being concentrated in these money center banks, you know, which is, you know, there's an obvious antitrust, you know, question in that, but, you know, there's, you know, but when the government, you know, adopts a policy in which a significant portion of the consumers of the market are being excluded for political reasons, that seems to be the nub of the issue here. So the question is, I've heard it, I think the other questioner suggested that perhaps the government will also be going after the so-called shadow financial market. Does the panel think that that's a real danger and that it also should be addressed, protecting the shadow financing industries?
I'll just say a couple words, which is Dodd-Frank was supposed to do one thing, which is get rid of too big to fail banks and never bail out banks again. I've been talking about Dodd-Frank ever since it was existed. I've spoken to thousands of people, and not a single person has ever believed that it actually does that, and that includes Tim Geithner, Elizabeth Warren, and Jeb Hensarling. So the whole thing was a joke in that sense, and we saw as soon as banks got in trouble last year, they bailed out a bunch of banks, right? So what Dodd-Frank has done is, as you suggest, accelerated consolidation, created the combination of banks that are too big to fail with banks that are too small to succeed because of the regulatory costs imposed by Dodd-Frank. And so it's exacerbated a lot of those problems of concentration and the like. What I'll add is the other thing, and Will kind of alluded to this, which is because of the way in which our world works today, where so much is electronic and that sort of thing, there is a sense in which banks have characteristics of public utilities. And common carrier type regulations, which is basically what fair access is, doesn't seem crazy in that world, right? The post office has to, is a private business, but has to deliver your mail, whether you're a Nazi or a communist, right? Banks, because of the way they're regulated, their essential nature, and the barriers to entry that are imposed on the business, I think it's reasonable to think about the sort of common carrier type regulation in the form of fair access as one potential way of doing that in addition to competition. So
why don't we take a question over here?
Thank you. Hi, my name is Stratton Hibbs. I'm a 1L at Columbia Law School. But I did work in the doldrums of a credit department in the pandemic, which was, I mean, fun's not the right word, but it was certainly insightful. I guess having an anecdote from that period and kind of seeing the 2023-2022 bank failures that kind of started Silvergate, Silicon Valley, and First Republic Bank that became the fourth, third, and second largest bank failures we've had since, good grief, since Washington Mutual in the 07-08 financial crisis. There was a big sort of initial political squabble about, you know, these, you know, state-chartered banks, was this a matter of, you know, California's excessive looseness with regards to, I think it was Silvergate was the first to fail, and it was particularly heavy in crypto, and California state bank regulators seem especially lenient towards crypto. But then on the other side, you said you had people saying, no, 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 it was these 2018 Trump-era financial deregulation policies about banks, I think it was beneath $100 billion in assets, received less scrutiny and less stress testing. And there became a really invigorated discussion about the extent to which state bank charters and state bank regulators should or should not serve as the sort of laboratories of democracy that Jefferson first mentioned. So I guess that's my primary question to you. In lieu of COVID-19, 07-08, and just all the financial uncertainty that has been the central operating paradigm, I'd say, of the 21st century, particularly post-08, is there still room in our economy for state regulators to act as laboratories of democracy? Or are these balkanization worries, as were brought up earlier, so much so that really we should see an aggregation towards the federal government and more federal oversight to ensure the constancy of our banking system?
John, you want to?
Yeah, I'll take a stab at that. Yes, there absolutely is room, and there should be room in the country for the state bank charter, and also for allowing different options for encouraging innovation, and even on the consumer and fintech side, they're trying to think about ways of setting up labs where you get some relief from existing laws and regulations. So absolutely. Listen, those banks failed. I mean, when individuals or particularly companies in this country fail, like, that shouldn't upset us. It shouldn't bother us. That's not these are ideas that people are trying to execute on. There's hundreds of industries, including tech in particular, where failure happens all the time, and it's okay. Obviously, when it happens in banking, you see people who are potentially going to lose money, and if those people are politically favored or politically sympathetic audience, then you get Congress caring a hell of a lot about the failure, because it's not really private capital that's sort of been put at risk. It's payroll, it's savings. Those banks failed. Silvergate was a little bit of an odd duck, but Silicon Valley, Signature, First Republic failed. They had bad management. They didn't manage their risk properly. I mean, if you talk to them, they would say, we didn't think the government was going to raise interest rates 500 basis points in 11 months, particularly when you had the leadership of the government standing up saying that this was all transitory and that we wouldn't need to raise rates. But they took on too much interest rate risk, right? They didn't hedge it properly. You know, at the end of the day, ultimately, like, they didn't have enough capital to support the risks that they were taking on. Now, they would say it was a tail risk that you didn't see it forecoming. I think that's what happened there. But how it was resolved in terms of, like, invoking the systemic risk exception, there's a lot of people who think that was a major mistake. It was basically a concession to the fact that too big to fail has not been solved, because the government obviously will step in. My own view was that these were not politically favored depositors and constituents, but I guess I'm pretty naive about how politically favored wealthy tech investors in Silicon Valley are.
I'll just say two things real quick. First, I think the dual banking system, as long as it makes sense, is what I've been talking about, rationalizing it, does make sense. A good example is a very large number of fintechs are partnered with state banks rather than national banks, primarily because state banks are a little more nimble, a little more cooperative to them, and less likely to see what they're doing as competitors to the products they're offering as opposed to supplements. So I think that's a good example. Second thing I would say is, in fact, I might go a step further, which is one thing I've urged and we talked about in the, or thought you would consider, talked about in the CFPB task force report, is giving non-banks access to the payment system. So one way of dealing with this problem of debanking and shutting off payments as opposed to other services would be to allow non-banks. Right now, you have to have a bank charter in order to access the payment system, but I think it's worth thinking about allowing different entities to be able to clear payments and that sort of thing, in, especially in real-time type payments. So,
let's take a question from here.
Randall Quarles from the Signature Group in Salt Lake City. So I agree with Will that
glad
really
to hear
the
it.
Most important that's my statement.
I hope there's a
button. you can stop there.
The
thank you for your question.
The most important question in this area is not sort of the government coming up to the banks and saying, nice little bank you have here, be a shame if anything happened to it. That happens, but it's clear that that's wrong. That's government action. And if there's express collusion or implicit collusion, if there's collusion among the banks in excluding borrowers, that's, you know, that's an antitrust problem and that's wrong. But it's not the whole story. I mean, the debanking of the fossil fuel companies, which happened during the Trump administration, was not a result of the Trump regulators coming in and saying, you need to do this, and it was not a result of the banks agreeing among themselves that they would do it. It was a result of their activist shareholders coming in and saying, you must do it or we will make your life a living hell. And you know, they said, well, let's think of an alternative. And so now Todd articulated a framework in which you could say, well, there's still something that the government can do about that. Essentially, the circumstances are such that common carrier legislation is justified. But I think that comes down to saying there's not enough competition in the banking industry. And I'm not sure that that's true, actually. I mean, we have 4,000 banks. Wells Fargo would have been glad to pick up that fossil fuel lending if we hadn't imposed that totally lawless asset cap on them. And it would have been great business for them. So I guess the question is, in the facts as we see them, if there isn't collusion and if there isn't sort of the mafia don action on the part of the government, how do we distinguish this, you know, this politicization of the private allocation of credit, which really disturbs me, from the Masterpiece Cake shop? Those people are really angry, as I'm angry about some of the actions that the banks have taken. You know, the folks who want their cake baked are really angry that they can't get it. It's not right for us to tell them that the shop must bake it.
Yeah. No, I think that's a fantastic question. I feel a little bit like in Pee-wee Herman's Playhouse when you said, like, the magic word, because this is, like, a perfect setup to talk about my hobby horse, which is ESG. And you mentioned the activist investors that had pushed those banks, and you could claim that probably, although there's some question, I think Trump may disagree with you as to how much control he had over any of his bureaucrat regulators and whether they were off doing things that he wouldn't necessarily agree with. I'll take, just for the sake of this argument, that let's say there wasn't any push from the banking regulators to treat disfavorably fossil fuels, and it was coming from the activist investors. I think that's hit such a fantastic example of what we're dealing with that's so difficult, and the banking part is just one part of it. And what I will say is I always caution people, do not use the textbook definition of ESG. It's a lie. ESG is supposedly this type of investing, like momentum investing or technical investing. That is not how it operates. What ESG is, if you look at if you were that Venn diagram of everything that I would include in the ESG phenomenon, ESG funds would be a tiny, tiny little dot inside of that. ESG is the financial services industry, writ large, using its market share to push political and social policy in the United States without having to face the electorate. And you hit upon another portion of that in your question, which is large asset managers like BlackRock, State Street, Vanguard, who are the major shareholders. Sometimes individually they are the top shareholders, and certainly collectively they become the top shareholders, and even worse, they become the most unified block of shareholders. So even if they only own 30% of a company, they may be the biggest block that votes collectively due to their membership in things like net zero asset managers. So when you have them pushing a company like Wells Fargo or any of the other banks who themselves have been subsumed into this cartel, you have a concentration of power that would make the Soviet Union blush. There are fewer numbers of people who control the U.S. economy right now than were members of the Presidium in the Soviet Union. And I think that speaks to something that no one really designed. No one, Charlie Munger, no less, said that, you know, I don't dislike Larry Fink, CEO of BlackRock, but I don't remember making him emperor. And that's what we've now found ourselves in. And again, it's not because Larry he's built a business, and I'll grant him that, he's done well, but he certainly has not done as well as the in relation to the power that he's aggregated him for himself by hoovering up the assets purchased on behalf of state, local, federal pension funds, institutional investors like universities that have large endowments. That is the power that Larry and his colleagues at State Street and Vanguard wield. And to make it even worse, because they are members of the indexes that they own themselves together, they own each other. So the largest shareholder in State Street, or one of the largest shareholders in State Street, is BlackRock. And one of the largest shareholders of BlackRock is State Street. So they have even cross protection against market participants who would push back on that. So I think you've hit on something. There is a move coming, quote unquote, from the market as well to push these banks. And it's widely known they will punish you through these shareholder proposals for objecting. One of the things that types of shareholder proposals that BlackRock and other large asset managers have voted to support have been where companies have to disclose any C3, C4, or political giving, whether to a PAC or to a candidate, where the recipient does not align with the company's net zero pledge. So that is about as close to a Mafia Don visit as you can get in the corporate world. Well, I take that back, because the stewardship committee of BlackRock does actually meet with the executive. That is one step higher. But that's basically saying, tell us who you've given money to that doesn't align with our political objectives that we've given to you, that we forced upon you, and if you publish it and we don't like it, we're going to penalize your compensation package. We're going to use it as a reasoning to vote against your compensation, to maybe replace boards of directors members like we saw with Exxon. And I think I generally think Darren has done a good job of running Exxon, but I think we saw the consequences this past week when they spoke, they waded into the political issue of getting in and out of the Paris Accords. That is a direct result of the Mafia Don tactics of BlackRock and other asset managers. So thank you for bringing that up, because I think you're right. It's broader than the things we've talked about today. But that doesn't necessarily get the banks off the hook, because I think what that really talks about is we may have created inadvertently an entire financial system that is so opposite of saturated, it's so collectivized, it's become so large that there's no accountability, and you have a principal agent problem that goes five or six steps deep. So the beneficial owners of these assets basically have no control about how they're being used.
Okay. Professor Zwicky asked for
one sentence, which is to elaborate on that, which is, we have traditionally thought of the ESG problem as a problem of shareholder governance, which it is a little bit, but it's primarily a problem of democracy and the use of the private power to basically overwhelm the political system, like Disney was trying to do in Florida. And I think we sort of, as a group of people who are concerned about this, need to think about what it looks like to solve a problem of democracy as opposed to just thinking of it as necessarily a problem of shareholder governance.
Well, thank you. I want to thank the panelists for a very robust conversation and the questions. And with that, we'll close for the day.
Thank you.
Great job.
Thanks. That was great. Fun. Yeah, very interesting stuff.
I learned. I feel like I should get a CLE credit.